The second thing I noticed, which did trip my alarm, was the top of the aquarium lying across the couch. In defense of celebrities, they all love Joe. No matter how coddled the quarterback or preening the guitarist, as soon as something goes wrong with their hand, they fly to Seattle because they heard about the guy. When the guy turns out to be unpretentious Joe, they become smitten. Joe waters the plants himself. His desk is a mess. The office is in constant chaos because he spends too long with each patient. He treats everyone the same, his curiosity a gentle rein. You'd have to draw him a picture to explain why it's cooler to save the pinky of a Cy Young Award-winning pitcher than the wrist of a checkout lady with carpal tunnel. Stars like people who fawn over them. They trust the few who don't. Nobody was behind the reception window. I moved closer. On the desk was an open container of tortellini salad, its bottled Italian dressing, a Proustian blast back to the past I wanted no part of, broke, in New York eating Korean deli salad bar. Deep in the office, Luz, the receptionist, caught sight of me. I waved. Luz walked over, wiping her hands on her jeans. Jeans plus stinky desk food equals 3-alarm situation. Luz slid the glass over. You're back. One thing that happens when you have an alcoholic for a parent is you grow up the child of an alcoholic. For those of you who aren't children of alcoholics, hear me now and believe me later. It's the single determining factor in your personality. I don't care if you get straight A's, marry a saint, and break the glass ceiling in a male-dominated profession, or if you bounce around from failure to failure with pit stops in cults and nut houses. If you were raised by a drunk, you're above all the adult child of an alcoholic. For a quick trip around the bases, it means you blame yourself for everything. You avoid reality. You can't trust people. You're hungry to please, which isn't all bad. Perfectionism makes the straight-A student. Lack of trust begets self-sufficiency. Low self-esteem can be a terrific motivator. If everyone were so gung-ho on reality, there'd be no art. An added bonus for having a drunk for a father is that in order to survive, I became freakishly attuned to subtle body language and inflections. Joe calls this heightened perception my witchly powers. And right then, to anybody else, "You're back," would have meant, "Nice to see you. It's been a while." But to the child of an alcoholic with witchly powers, it meant, "Joe told us the three of you were out of town." And that's when my day really began. Ruthie, in the way back, spotted us. Ruthie, the office manager, and Luz, the scheduler, were a pair of evil cats. Placid eyes, grins, seething with calculation, they worked in tandem with a single purpose, to protect Joe. Ruthie, the mastermind, was 60, blonde, with a dancer's body. She always wore beige. Today's ensemble was a silk top, pointy 4-inch heels, and slacks with a crease down the front that could slice you in half. I wanted information. If I tipped Ruthie off, she'd run straight to Joe. My witchly instincts told me that whatever this was, Joe telling me he was at work, but the office, he was out of town, I needed to low-key it. Evil cats versus the adult child of an alcoholic? May the better animal win. This is a surprise, Ruthie said, revealing nothing. We're back, I said, safe ground, as I was merely repeating what Luz had just said. Two workmen walked through the back hallway. Propped against the wall, a roll of carpet. "New carpet?" I said. "We never have a whole week," erupted Luz. "A whole week? Ruthie put her hand on Luz's shoulder. A signal to say no more? What was that I sensed from 4 feet away? Could it be Ruthie's heart rate dropping? Had the kitty cat checkmated me? "I parked in the garage," I said. Then, in a prison move, if there ever was one, I reached across and rifled around Luz's desk, touching as much of her personal shit as I could. An appalled Luz turned to Ruthie, who coolly opened a drawer and handed me validation stickers. "Take the whole book," she said. Timby was up on a chair with both hands in the aquarium, swishing his fingers through the fetid water. "Whee!" "Let's go," I said. Out in the hallway, I found a wall-mounted hand sanitizer dispenser. Trembling, I pushed the button. It squirted on the floor. I scooped up the puff of foam and knelt down to scrub it into Timby's arms.
"Oh, no," he cried. "Was that water dirty?"
"Not necessarily."
"Smell the soup. Cool the soup," Timby said.
"Huh?"
"It's what they teach us in school when we're upset. Smell the soup."
He took a deep breath in.
"Cool the soup,"
he blew out.
"Come on, Mama, close your eyes."
I stood up, eyes closed. I smelled the soup. I cooled the soup. My arms rose slightly at my sides. My palms turned inward on their own. My fingers curled like fortune-telling fish.
"I think I need moisturizer," Timby said,
his arms pink from the alcohol. "We'll get you some, baby." I dialed Sydney. "Eleanor again, this really is the last time, but I do have to cancel. Call me so I know you got this message." I turned to Timby. "Me and you."
"Really?"
His fragile hope just about put me away. "What do you want to do?" I said. "Anything. We can go paddleboarding on Lake Union, get a sandwich to eat at the top of Smith Tower, fly kites on Kite Hill, watch the salmon swim upstream at the Ballard Locks."
"Can we go to the Gap?"
To the Gap we walked. "This is all about you, baby," I said. Timby tore up the Lucite stairs to the kids' section. I followed him, my mind barely there. Husband caught lying equals husband having an affair. It felt like a first idea. It felt pat. My friend Merrill told me that on the first date, a guy without realizing it will tell you why the relationship will ultimately fail. He'll say he doesn't want kids, or he's not the type to settle down, or he's in a fight with his mother. On our first date, Joe presented himself as the kind, curious, principled man he turned out to be. Only one thing struck me as odd. I don't know how it came up, but he said his coping style was that he takes it, he takes it, he takes it, until he can't take it anymore. "What does it look like when you can't take it anymore?" I'd asked. "I don't know," he'd answer. "It hasn't happened yet." The previous guy I dated was still hung up on his ex. The one before him was 15 days sober. If the worst Joe could say about himself was there'd be unspecified wall punching in the future, sign me up. And even that didn't materialize. 20 years and nary a call to the drywall guy. More than anything, Joe is ethical. I once pointed out the irony of him constantly railing against the Catholic Church when he is, in fact, a walking advertisement for the decency and honesty they preach. "When they're not pumping you with lies and self-hatred," he retorted. No way could he be cheating on me. On the other hand, I wasn't giving him enough sex. I had to get on that. I poked my head into the dressing room. Timby was trying on corduroy shorts and a T-shirt of a corgi playing drums. Timby's roll of dimpled paper-white belly fat popped out over the waistband.
"Do you think they have knee socks?" he asked.
"Not in the boys' section," I knew not to say. And then I remembered, this morning, Joe face down at the table, forehead on the newspaper. Perhaps he'd seen something in it. "I'm running across the street to Barnes & Noble just for a sec."
"Wait," Timby said. "You're leaving me here alone?"
Before I could fumble for an answer, he said,
"Can I pick out something else?"
The kid had a gambler's instinct for knowing when to press. "One thing." I shot to the bookstore, bought a Seattle Times, and hustled outside. In the few minutes that took, a stack of wooden barricades had appeared on the sidewalk. Seattle was breaking out in a rash of police blue. Did I fail to mention that the Pope was coming to town? Ah, yeah. For something called World Youth Day, Does that not sound like a bogus event the Joker would dream up to ensnare Robin? His Holiness was scheduled to perform Mass at the Mariners Stadium on Saturday. I thumbed through the newspaper. Seahawks, Seahawks, Seahawks. Pope, Pope, Pope. A lady was setting out food for crows and her neighbors were pissed. Any of these could have driven Joe to despair. Or none. What a royal frustration. Of course I hadn't pushed it this morning with Joe. Isn't that one of the benefits of plodding through so many years of marriage? You get to take things at face value. None of that, you look upset. I'm not upset. Please talk to me. I am talking to you. Is it me? I told you I'm fine. It is me. Oh, just thinking about it takes me back to Friday nights spent weeping through step class. By the time I got back to the Gap, Timby had pulled a supermarket sweep. A girl with a headset was ringing up a haystack of clothes. Between scanner beeps, Timmy whispered, "Hurry, hurry!" "Don't think you got away with this," I said, coming up behind him. "I know you tricked me." "Will you be using your Gap card today?" the girl asked. "No, and I don't want one," I said, "and we're never coming back."
"You ruin everything," Timby said.
"No, you ruin everything." The sales girl's smile didn't falter, but that didn't mean she couldn't wait to get home and tell her roommate. It was 11:45 and still no word from Sydney. Out on the street, a white police bus had parked across 6th Avenue, blocking traffic. I dialed Sydney's number. As it rang, I pointed to the bus. "Look," I said to Timby. "The Pope must be staying at the Sheraton." "That's what you get when you call yourself the People's Pope. You have to stay at a dump."
"I wish I could stay at the Sheraton."
Voicemail again. "Sydney? It's Eleanor. Please call me. I don't want you showing up at lunch and I'm not there. Or maybe I should go. I don't know." I hung up. See, this is why I can't stand Sydney Madsen.
"I thought she was your friend."
"It's a grown-up thing." I pulled the newspaper from under my arm and pointed to the date. "Read that to me." Timby did. I handed him my date book. "Look up today, Thursday, October 8th. Tell me what it says."
"Spencer Martell."
"Give me that." I yanked away the book. In my own hand, Spencer Martell.
"Who's Spencer Martell?"
Timby asked. "I can't imagine." Spencer Martell, whoever it was, I had made a lunch date with him, her.
"Who's Spencer Martell?"
Timby asked again. "Do I look like I know?"
"It's okay, Mom," he said. "You did it on accident."
"It's by accident. Who's teaching you to speak?" I took out my phone and searched Spencer Martell. One email came up from a month ago. From Spencer Martell to Eleanor Flood. Re, long time no see. "By any chance are you free for lunch on October 8th? I'd love to catch up. X. S." I scrolled down and found my response. A 12 o'clock reservation at Mam Noon. It was now 10 of.
"Maybe he's related to Sydney Madsen," Timby offered. "He could be her brother."
"We're about to find out, aren't we?"
"I'm coming too,"
Timby said with big eyes. "Me and you." As for my constant low-grade state of confusion, the blur is a term that seems to be sticking. Let me break it into three categories. 1, things I should know but never learned. 2, things I choose not to know. And 3, things I know but totally screw up. Things I should know but never learned, my left from my right. Sorry, but you better ask someone else for directions. Things I choose not to know? Plenty. There's only so much a good brain has room for, let alone a bad brain like mine. So I made an executive decision. There would be subjects I'd aggressively take no interest in, such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Lena Dunham, the whereabouts of the stolen paintings from the Isabella Stewart Gardner heist, what GMO even stands for, and, until Timby's flirtation with knee socks in the Gap 5 minutes ago, gender identity. If that makes my human existence a limited one, I stoically accept my fate. Today's prevailing stance seems to be, I have an opinion, therefore I am. My stance, I have no opinion, therefore I am superior to you. Things I know but always screw up? Times. If I have a lunch at 12:30, I'll write 12:30 in my book. But along the way, some alchemy happens in my brain, and 12:30 becomes 1 o'clock. You'd think that after arriving for the theater a half an hour after curtain, a dozen times, I'd have learned to triple-check the ticket. But no. I wish I could explain it. One of life's enigmas. My point is, switching Spencer Martell to Sidney Madsen might send you running to the neurologist, but to me, it's a shrug fest. A parking space gaped across the street from the restaurant. What if this was my only karmic blessing of the day? I almost hated to waste it. This is going to be a grown-up lunch, you understand that? I said, sticking the parking receipt on the inside of the window.
Will it be inappropriate?
Timby asked, climbing out of the car, hugging the gift basket. We're going to talk about what we're going to talk about, and you'll have to just sit there to nip it in the bud in terms of can we go nows, and the answer is no.
What if there is an earthquake?
What did I say?
Can I listen to the radio on your phone?
No, but I do have those books on tape.
It's all Laura Ingalls Wilder.
You have been ruined by literally not even, I said.
What's literally not even?
That horrible show you're always watching.
It's called I Know, Right?
Then I Know, Right? has totally ruined you, I said.
God, Mom, Timby said. You've never even seen it.
Don't listen to anything, I said. Just sit there.
Fine, Timby said bitterly. Laura Ingalls Wilder.
While we waited to cross the street, a homeless guy passed by. White with dreads, a beard, and red everything. Skin, eyes, peeling hands, tops of his bare feet. His face, his whole body, searched for something, anything. Come here, I pulled Timby in.
Is he mentally ill?
I just want to hold you close. I gave Timby a squeeze. He relaxed in my embrace. I'm wild about you, you know that, right?
I know,
he smiled up at me. You don't have to be wild about me, too. Just try to like me a little more than you do now. We entered Mamnoon with its ebony walls, industrial ceiling, fabulous bursts of geometric mosaic, and whimsical, but not too whimsical, chandeliers. I don't care where you live, but here in Seattle, our restaurants are better than your restaurants. I said. Who are we looking for?
Spencer Martell, Timby said.
I know that, I snapped. Deep in the restaurant, a man stood and waved. 30s, skinny, he wore a yellow gingham shirt, a brown belt, and black jeans. There he is, I said, waving back. I know him.
From where? Timby asked.
15 steps away, he looked familiar. 8 steps away, and I almost remembered. And there we were. Spencer! Eleanor, he said with deep affection.
You!
Timby shot me a look. Who is it? I shot him a look back. Don't ask me. Is this your son? Spencer asked. You've met? I said, not sure.
We brought you a basket, Timby said.
If I'd known you were coming, Spencer said to Timby, hands on bent knees, I'd have brought you something, too. Timby did the math quicker than Bobby Fischer and spotted a leather case on the table. He grabbed it and snapped it open. On a bed of satin rested an orange Mont Blanc pen, the kind I used to use, the kind they stopped making forever ago. The roll of all, Spencer said to me, if I remember correctly. I can't believe you found one! The weight of it, the unlikeliness of its clownish color, the double click of the top coming off and on in my hand. On eBay, I can only find midnight blue. And teal, Spencer jumped in, and forest green and yellow. But orange, I said, this is precious cargo.
I want to see.
Timby grabbed the pen. How wonderful and unexpected. I looked Spencer in the eye. Thank you.
How do you know my mom?
Timby, my wingman, before he could open his mouth. Gah! Spencer Martell, from Looper Wash! It had been over 10 years since he'd shambled out of the office. I worked with your mom a long time ago. The warmth in his voice belied the ugly memory that was reloading in my brain with alarming speed. When Spencer walked into the bullpen that first day, he looked the part. Moleskin notebook, black wing, pencils, vintage glasses. He dropped the names of the right artists. Robert Williams, Alex Gray, Tara MacPherson, Adrian Tomina. However, he was so nervous and eager to ingratiate himself that his presence was excruciating. He'd arrive each Monday having scoured Brooklyn swap meets for items we animators might add to our various collections. I mentioned once that I liked caramel brownies, and the next day he brought in a tray, homemade. How could I have even hired him? Oh, that's right, I didn't hire him. We got him for free through the network's minority hiring program. Then it turned out he was just a quarter Mexican and that he'd gamed the system to get the job. Oh, and he couldn't even draw. He kept badgering me with questions about every tiny gesture and expression. I wasn't there to help him. He was there to help me. I needed people to shut up, churn out drawings, and stick to the model sheet. Spencer quickly realized he was in over his head. His flop sweat made him radioactive. When his 8-week option was up, his spirit was so broken that he'd already packed his boxes. He sat in his empty office waiting to get fired. I gutlessly made someone else do it, but Spencer didn't come out for an hour. The only sign he was alive was sobbing through the door. I went in. I gave him some career advice. It came out wrong. I waved over the first person dressed in black. We need to order.
We do?
Timby said. I turned to Spencer. And just so you know,
you don't share, he said. I remember. Can I get 2 things?
Timby asked.
1.
We ordered. And there we were. Me, Timby, and my quarter Mexican, Natalie attired ghost of Christmas past, mooning at me from across the table. Someone had to say something.
Spencer Martell.
I can't believe you answered my email, he said. I'd always assumed you'd rather forget me.
Of course not, I said with an insouciant wave that knocked my water into the dipping oil.
Timby was starting to look concerned. Spencer mopped up the water with his napkin and moved his phone to the dry side. It gave me an idea. Timby, I said, go wash your hands.
But
fish poop, I said, or you're not eating French fries, and they have the best French fries. Timby burned me with a stare and left. Spencer, I leaned across the table. If I dial a number from your cell phone, will you try to make a doctor's appointment? The poor guy looked poleaxed. I'd already grabbed his phone and dialed Joe's office. I don't want them to know it's me. Just ask when the next available appointment is. I held Spencer's phone to his ear. I could hear Lou's answer. I motioned wildly for Spencer to start talking.
Yes, hello, he stammered. I'd like to make an appointment.
Lou's explained something on the other end.
Ask when he's coming back,
I whispered.
When's he coming back?
Spencer said weakly. Monday, said Lou's. That's all I needed to know. I snatched the phone from Spencer, hung it up, and placed it on the table. He looked down at it, then up at me, uncertain if the last minute had actually happened. Dr. Wallace, Spencer said, isn't that your husband, Joe? Are you divorced?
We're happily married.
Timby slid back in beside a thoroughly charmed or slightly disgusted Spencer. It was hard to tell which. I'm kidding. He was disgusted.
Spencer, I said, tell us about you.
Well, that's a 3-hour tour, he said, reassuming his happy-to-be-here persona. The abridged version will do, I said. When I left Lupa Wash, I had to heave my breath up and out. I was trying to be helpful. What did you do? Timby asked. It's not important, I said. The difficult people are our most valuable teachers, Spencer said.
What did she do to you?
Timby was dying. Don't you have music to listen to? I said.
I'm good.
Spencer pulled out a stylish messenger bag and opened it for Timby. I have some picture books you can look at, he said, placing a few on the bench between them. Timby ignored the offer and raised his eyebrows as if to say, You may proceed. When I got hired at Looper Wash, Spencer said, it was the happiest day of my life. I thought I'd arrived. I moved out of my parents' apartment in Queens. I bought a Vespa. I spent all my money on gifts for the other animators. Which I, for one, really appreciated. That signed Stephen Sondheim playbill is still one of my most treasured possessions. I held my hand to my face to block even a peripheral view of Timby. Then I got fired. The shame of it. There I was, living in the East Village, in an apartment I couldn't afford. I couldn't face my parents. For the first time in my life, I wasn't sharing a bedroom with 5 brothers and sisters, and I could finally act on the fact that I... He looked at Timby, unsure. Didn't like girls. He knows all about it. I flipped my head toward Timby. I let him watch the Tonys. Oh, well, the first guy I fell in love with was a drug addict. The hard stuff, quicker than you might imagine, I ended up broke and with nowhere to live. But no matter how low I sank, I knew I was an artist. Despite what you said, I knew I was more than a careerist. I'd called him that. I was hoping he'd forgotten.
What's a careerist? Asked Timby.
I had to look it up, too, Spencer said. It's someone who only thinks about getting ahead in his or her career.
That's not bad, Timby said, disappointed.
Spencer put his hand to his heart. Even now, when I think back on Looper Wash, the pangs of humiliation can make me drop the glass in my hand. I was so naive, such an embarrassment to myself.
Not at all, I said. It just wasn't the right fit. You had nowhere to live?
Timby prompted helpfully. I'd lost all belief in myself, Spencer said, but something deep within kept me going, a feeling of hope, and that hope was a pulsing, radiant green.
Green hope! I cried.
It was the tip of a crocus breaking through the winter. It was the shag carpet in the basement of a ranch house. It was the lace on my sister's quinceañera dress. Stop me if you've already heard this. Me? I coughed, completely baffled as to how I could have. If I captured those greens, he said, it would release the artist who'd been taken hostage by the careerist. He unbuttoned his shirt cuffs, held together by silk French knots. He rolled up his sleeves and brandished his inner arms. On each a tattoo from wrist to elbow, green paint sample strips.
Whoa, said Timby.
That's quite a commitment, I said, then noticed his watch, vintage Cartier. I refuse to let my failure at Looper Wash define me, Spencer said. I spent my last dollar on a painting at a thrift shop just for the canvas. Painted it green, and while the paint was still wet, cried onto it.
I said. Mom, you're mean!
Spencer removed the napkin from his lap, folded it, and placed it on the table. He stood up and walked over to me. Were my arms shielding my face, maybe, but instead of striking me, Spencer hugged me. It took breathing exercises from childbirth class to survive his bewildering, tuberose-scented act of compassion. Timby, traumatized, gave me a look.
What's he doing?
I gave him one back, no idea. Spencer returned to his seat. Timby handed him his napkin. There was no choice now but to respect the dude. You're right, Spencer said. It was sentimental and muddled. But it was the first true thing I'd ever done. That painting is here, in Seattle. I'd love to show it to you.
I want to see it, Timby said.
Read a book. Listen to me, Spencer smacked his forehead. I promised I'd make it short. So I came out, became a junkie, got these tattoos, cleaned up, and, well, you know about the past 12 years.
I do.
Yale School of Art, group show at White Columns, Jack Wolgan Prize, Venice Biennale, blah, blah, blah. My eyes closed. My face scrunched. My head shook 1,000 tiny times.
Huh?
I thought you knew about me, Spencer said to Timby.
Your mom?
But Timby had become absorbed in one of Spencer's books. Spencer turned back to me. That's why I crave you, Eleanor. You have a way of frying my motherboard when I need it the most.
It's not intentional, I said. I promise.
The contemporary art world is so insular. We think our sky-high prices make us the center of the universe, when of course only about 8 people are paying attention. And they're just gallery owners and art consultants.
Spencer joined his hands and lowered his chest in a slight bow.
I honor you.
That's you? I said, still gaga.
Yale? Venice?
I'm having a solo show at the Seattle Art Museum, he said. They asked me to do some stuff at the Sculpture Park, too. There are banners all over town. Of course, I just presumed you saw my name flapping in the breeze everywhere you went. But here you are again, holding up the mirror.
This toadying wannabe, this sweaty ass-kisser, this fraudulent quasi-minority, now he was somebody? Now he was the shit?
He turned everything topsy-turvy, and instead of rubbing my face in it, instead of serving revenge cold, he was nothing but hugs and $200 pens and pervy gratitude and...
Mom?
It was Timby. He held up what he'd been reading. From Spencer's bag. A fancy magazine or catalog. Took me a second to even recognize it.
The Minerva Prize. From my Looper Wash days.
It was a prize, now defunct, for graphic novelists.
I'd been nominated for one in 2003 by Dan Klaus. That year's Minerva Prize winner was going to be announced at a dinner at the Odeon. We were in the middle of production on Looper Wash, and I intended to blow off the ceremony, but at the last minute I grabbed the gang and walked over. We were horribly underdressed and seated at a good table. Across the expertly lit orchid centerpiece, the wife of the arts commissioner looked askance at our rowdiness and dirty jokes. Ask anyone, being in production on TV shows turns you feral. I didn't expect to win, and didn't.
We each came back with a swag bag. Palm Wonderful, a Mirakami thumb drive, a mug with the Bear Stearns motto, ahead of the curve, and that program.
I wasn't invited to the ceremony, of course, Spencer was telling Timby, but the next morning I fished a program out of the trash. The other day I was doing some spring cleaning and came across it. I thought your mom might want it.
Something terrible was occurring to me.
What? Spencer asked.
That program, the one Timby had in his hands.
It had profiles of each nominee and their work, which meant my work, all 12 illustrations.
Hey, I said to Timby, reaching across, give me that. He yanked it away.
Who are the Flood Girls?
The Flood Girls. Eleanor Flood. Nominated by Daniel Klaus. I first met Eleanor Flood in 1995, back in the olden days of what we once called the San Diego Con, to differentiate it from Dallas Con, Sac Con, Leper Con. A few years before, it was gentrified by Hollywood, and comics were still the main focus.
Off in the indie alternative underground ghetto corner, it was me, Peter Bagg, Joe Matt, the Hernandez brothers, Ivan Brunetti, the usual gang of idiots. We'd sit at tables with our art spread out, praying that Matt Groening would come along and buy something. We were strong believers in noblesse oblige. For long stretches, nobody even glanced our way, and the only time we got anyone was when the line for Todd McFarlane was so long that the occasional bearded man-child would shuffle a few steps off his path to deliver a disdainful glare or perhaps use one of my originals as a coaster for his drink. It was during a soul-numbing moment of career introspection, such as this, that an anomalous young woman emerged from behind the crowd. She had good posture and wore a dress. An actual dress, not a troll queen dress. She was apparently a fan of 8-Ball, because she recognized the pages I was selling. Ghost World, that's the cutest, and I can't believe you're selling ugly girls, it's super cute. Cute wasn't a word I usually heard in relation to my art. Ew was number one, followed by why. I saw her turn to survey the now endless McFarlane line. I suppose I should feel sorry for them, she said. What's the point in that? I responded. They don't even know they're sad. We discussed whether this gave us the right to hate them and agreed that it probably did. And she picked up my whole portfolio and asked, would it be bad if I just bought everything? I told her, that would be fine. She wrote me a check. Eleanor Flood, New York, New York. The next time I saw her was 9 years later. I was in New York for something and promised my sister I'd go see my nephew who was answering phones for a production company. She said, you know the show Looper Wash, the short about girls on ponies that played before Ice Age, and now it's a series on Fox? I had no idea what she was talking about, thank God. So I just said, what's the address? I went to a building in Soho, which sounds impressive, but surely was not, and walked up to the fourth floor. Apparently, everyone was in a screening down the hall because the place was deserted. In a corner office, I saw a drawing board with a big mirror propped in front of it. That struck me as exactly the kind of egomaniacal, solipsistic, self-focus I so admire in myself. So I went over to explore further. On the drawing board, along with viciously mean doodles of Fox executives, which instantly endeared this person to me, were colored pencil illustrations. They were busy and pretty, full of soft tints and deliberate expressions, which aren't qualities I usually go for. But they were also disturbing, and not in the usual ironic jughead with a crack pipe way. They were disturbingly sincere. I heard a bubbly voice. Dan Close! It was Eleanor Flood. It turns out she was the animation director at Looper Wash, and my nephew had told her I was coming. She pulled out the portfolio of my art she'd bought years before. Do you want any of these back? She said. A lot of them are probably worth a fortune now. I feel bad. I could cry sometimes thinking of how little I paid for them. I actually had cried thinking the same thing. I told her she could keep them. She saw me looking at her drawings. I know, she said. Aren't those super cute? Yes, they were, I said, studying them for an awkwardly long time. The Minerva asked me to nominate, I said. Do you think I could submit these? But isn't that for graphic novelists, she asked. Put these together and you've got a comic. Even back then, I couldn't bring myself to use the term graphic novel. She got what I meant. Oh, she said. Unlike many stories about childhood, the Flood Girls feels immediate and present tense urgent. Though it's dense with period detail, a nostalgia trip it is not. The vantage is frank and unsentimental. That Eleanor Flood is able to infuse these ominous, cryptic images with so much warmth is a rare trick, and I look forward to seeing more.
Cracked Actor.
"You never told me you had a sister,"
Timby said to me over the top of the catalog. "I don't have a sister," I said. There it was, finally. My lie. Now a citizen of the world. Before I fell asleep at night, I'd cycle through the various intonations in my head, preparing myself for this awful, inevitable moment. I don't have a sister. 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 Sometimes I'd say it out loud without realizing. Timby from the back seat.
"What do you keep saying?"
Me from the front. "Nothing." Sometimes it'd show on my face. Joe. "What are you thinking about?" Me. "Nothing. Why?" Joe. "Your teeth are bared."
"But Tess Tyler was your mom,"
Timby said.
"And Parsley was your dog. And..."
"The Flood Girls represents two sides of me," I snapped. "It was an artistic experiment. That's all." The French fries arrived, a crispy umber heap sprinkled with chopped fresh herbs.
"Whoa,"
Timby said.
"I call most of them."
Could it be? Could I have just gotten away with the whole thing?
"Wait till you try the ketchup,"
I said, a tremor in my voice. "They make it themselves." "But Spencer..." Confusion had broken out across his face. His eyes were squinting, his brows were coming together, his mouth was opening, words were coming out. "But didn't I meet your sister?" For clarity, I do have a sister. Her name is Ivy. I created the Flood Girls as a gift for her. Until Dan Klaus happened across those illustrations years ago, it had never occurred to me to turn them into a graphic novel. Enter Joyce Prim, junior editor at Burton Hill. Doing what junior editors did, troll obscure prize dinners for promising talent. Late 20s, rail thin, pure confidence, Joyce cornered me in the Odeon ladies' room.
"Violet Perry gets all the credit for Looper Wash," she said. "It's time we right that wrong."
"Nice try," I said, "but Violet is a dear friend. No crime has been committed."
"I want more Eleanor Flood," Joyce said. "The Flood Girls begs to be expanded."
"This is highly flattering," I said, "but I'm no graphic novelist."
"Daniel Klaus thinks otherwise," she said. "So do I."
"I have no story to tell," I said. She handed me her card.
"Call me when you change your mind."
Then, years later, something terrible happened, and I did have a story to tell. I called up Joyce, by then executive editor of Burton Hill. She flew to Seattle. We had drinks at the W Hotel. Joyce had on 3-inch heels, peach pants, a floral, crinkly silk shirt buttoned low, and a long gold chain. Her face was makeup-free, and she wore her long hair in an effortless chignon. Anytime I get into a one-on-one social situation, especially if there's something at stake, my anxiety spikes. I talk fast. I jump topics unexpectedly. I say shocking things. Right before I push it too far, I double back and expose a vulnerability. If I see you about to criticize me, I leap in and criticize myself. One shrink labeled this the trick. Halfway through our first session, he stopped me mid-yak. He said I was so afraid of rejection that I turned every interaction into a life-or-death charm offensive. That I was so unrelentingly verbal made me, in his opinion, untreatable. He handed me back my check and wished me luck. The best, worst thing about the trick? People fall for it every time. Over drinks, Joyce and I became instant buddies.
Moscow mules became dinner. Became, you've got to see this cute hat I bought. Upstairs in her room, Joyce gave me her cologne. I'd admired the scent, but it could be bought only in Paris. I told her she dressed like a spring when she was really a summer. I wrote her a list of colors she needed to start wearing. She confessed to being on the verge of an affair with a married author. I told her I was the direct descendant of a U.S. president. I'm not speaking metaphorically when I say we tried on each other's shoes. It was 1 in the morning before I remembered. The book! You may not know this yet, Joyce said, masterfully switching into editor mode. But you're a writer. You think like a writer. Yes, I want those Flood Girls illustrations, but I want your words, too. Is the book mostly words, mostly pictures? I don't know. Every book has to invent itself. I'm giving you complete freedom. Use those illustrations. Just put what's in there, she pointed to my head and said, on the page. I don't know if I got Joyce primed or if she got Eleanor flooded, but I skipped out of there with a book deal. I did meet your sister, Spencer was saying, utterly flummoxed. She was willowy. She always came by. Must have been someone else, I pronounced and sealed it with a smile. Spencer looked like the guy in Alien before he started blurping up that white stuff. He checked his watch. Hi, he said to a passing waiter. Would you mind terribly bringing us the check? Now, Timby said, having hardly made a dent in the heap of fries. We'll get a box for those, I said. I don't have a sister. I don't have a sister.
French fries aren't good to go, said Timby.
You two stay, Spencer said. I have to find my way to the sculpture park for a meeting with my curator. Thank God Spencer had no way of knowing we lived 3 blocks from the sculpture park, that it was where I brought Yo-Yo for his midday walk.
We're going there too, Timby erupted. We can give you a ride.
I saw panic in Spencer's eyes. No, darling, I said to Timby. Spencer's a busy man. He's not going to want to go home with us first and get the dog and, you know.
I can show you my art, Timby said to Spencer, and then you can show me your art.
Timby's voice had a plaintive little squeak to it. Spencer equaled trapped animal. Lying in bed this morning, I had set the bar laughably low. Look people in the eye. Get dressed. Smile. It should have been a Sunday drive. Then that prankster reality appeared in the pickup truck ahead of me and started tossing watermelons out the back. And it wasn't even 1 o'clock. Today, at the very least, I'd fulfill my promise to Timby. I'd make it his day. I looked at Spencer with what must have been desperation. Sure, he said. I guess we could all go.
Yay! Cried Timby.
I owe you one, I whispered to Spencer as we left the restaurant. It all evens out, he said tightly.
I flung open the front door with a flourish that said the hills were alive with the sound of music, when really I wanted a head start to make sure the toilets were flushed. On the off chance Spencer still admired me, I didn't want to queer it by him seeing our toilets full of pee. Guess who didn't greet me at the door? Yo-Yo! He didn't even raise his chin off the rim of his bed. The most he could muster was to follow me around with watery put-upon eyes.
Would you look at this view? I said, momentarily confused that I was Spencer seeing my apartment for the first time. Spencer couldn't be helped but be pulled toward the floor-to-ceiling windows and our cartoonish panorama of Seattle, snowy Mount Rainier, Space Needle, Pacific Science Center arches, container ships of Elliott Bay.
We were so nervous about the infamous Seattle weather that Joe said, let's give ourselves half a chance of avoiding a murder-suicide and get a place with lots of light.
I had to stop talking. I popped into the bathroom, flush, nice save, and emerged babbling.
This is where the magic happens, I said, presenting Spencer the walk-in pantry I'd converted into my studio. Or doesn't, depending on the day.
Spencer poked his head in. The space was barely big enough for my drawing table, The walls pinned floor to ceiling with a mad jam of photos, images torn from magazines, notes to myself, random trinkets. On the floor, waist-high stacks of the photography books I use for reference, and a glass jug that held the stubs of all the colored pencils I'd ever burned through. "Thank God you're an artist," I said to Spencer. "Most people who sneak a peek think I'm batshit." Spencer couldn't resist a closer look at my current project. I was working on a commission for the Telluride Film Festival, fiddling around with the idea of the knots and aspen trees looking like eyes or something. Scattered on the table were strips of film, glass eyes I'd found at a curio shop, and an out-of-print book flagged for Herbert Bayer photographs. "Imagine being you," I said, "seeing the inside of my car, apartment, and studio in the same day. Must feel like skipping first and second base and going straight to third." "If I'm making you nervous," Spencer said, "I can just go." "Don't go!" I screeched, scaring even myself. Joe's and Timby's breakfast dishes were still on the table, a diorama of half-eaten toast and half-finished orange juice. "It's like the final day of Pompeii around here." "You and your sister," Spencer said quietly. "It's none of my business what happened. I'm not judging. You can stop."
"Stop what?"
"Why are you guys fighting?" Timby asked. "How about you show me that art?" Spencer said to him. I hustled into Joe's office for the first time since the shock of the flood girls. It was just me and me. My body knew it and involuntarily dropped into Joe's leather chair. This. Shit. The lethargy pressed down on me. My breathing slowed. I lowered my face into my spiderweb fingers. Ivy. Whenever I think of her, the first image I always have. She's in profile, in her 20s, smiling curious. She was born trusting and stayed that way, believed in people, saw the good in their stories, their intentions, played along with how they wanted to be perceived. Her skin was so delicate you could see a blue vein running along her strong jaw. Her physical beauty was the first thing people noticed. She spoke quietly, drawing them into where they wanted to be, closer to her. I wonder if she learned that from our mother, who could only whisper toward the end. Mom's friend Gigi would pick Ivy and me up every day after school and take us to the hospital. Each day, Mom's voice grew weaker. Then one day, it was Daddy standing at the school gate. I was 9, Ivy was 5. My memories of our mother's death, not the dying itself, but the days after, are a numb jumble dominated by my father's cluelessness and the flamboyant grief of show people. 40 years later, though, the memories that cause my chest to curl in and ache are those of Ivy. Within a week of her death, Mom's friends threw a celebration of her life. Broadway was dark on Mondays, so they borrowed the Minskoff where Bette Midler was doing a one-woman show. Daddy, Ivy, and I arrived at the theater and found ourselves receiving condolences in a random huddle in the center aisle. At the back of the stage, in the shadows, was the huge mechanical ape hand in which Bette Midler made her entrance. The lights flickered. Father Kidney started up the steps to the mic. But the theater wasn't a quarter full. "Shouldn't we wait for everyone?" I asked Daddy. "It's a big theater," he said, and we took our seats. I began to tremble. This was how her tribe, as my mother called her theater friends, wanted her remembered? A priest speaking on a borrowed stage in front of another woman's props to an empty house? My mother wasn't theirs to humiliate. She belonged to me. She was elegant and precise. She'd gone to boarding school in Switzerland and made us cheese soufflés and the little ramekins and posed nude for a German photographer and filled our house with fresh flowers. I turned to Ivy. "We're leaving. I want to see the show." I yanked her away. We sat on velvet chairs in the lobby and fell asleep, awaking to the wail of bagpipes. Daddy couldn't face sleeping in her bed, so he'd been spending the nights on the couch. But it was the cat's couch. The morning after the memorial, the three of us were silently eating the food people had brought. Weird stuff in unfamiliar casseroles. Shepherd's pie with ground beef, not lamb. Lasagna that tasted of cinnamon. Macaroni and cheese with peas. All of it only compounding our dread of what the world would be like without Mom in it. The cat hopped up on the couch, squatted over the spot where Daddy's head had been, and, staring straight at us, peed. It was completely evil and felt personal, as if Pumpkin were saying, "You think you have it bad now? Try this!" I guess Daddy had to take his bottled fury and fear out on something and better the cat than us, but still, I should have hurried Ivy out of there. That afternoon, Gigi and another friend of Mom's, Alan, came over, and Daddy took Ivy and me to the park. When we returned, Gigi and Alan were gone. The couch was gone. Pumpkin was gone. Everything of Mom's had been removed. The dresses in her closet, the sweaters and silk scarves folded in her drawers, the hats on the shelves, her jewelry, her makeup, even her lingering smell had vanished. In the hallway sat two boxes, one marked Eleanor, one marked Ivy. The only thing Daddy kept were Tyler family heirlooms, a pair of antique Derringers. That night, while Daddy snored in his bed, I stared at those two boxes for hours. I finally picked them up, walked them to the incinerator chute, and tossed them in. The scratch of sequins and beads against cardboard still haunts me. A week later, Daddy drove us to Colorado. He didn't tell us it would be one way. He'd met a woman from Dallas who had a second house in Aspen. We could live in the guest house in exchange for Daddy doing maintenance and small repairs. In the 70s, Aspen was a funky former mining town with the best powder in the world, attracting mostly Texans. It was more cowboy hats and Wranglers than Mariah Carey and Gulfstream 550s. In New York, Daddy had installed sound systems for a living. His hope was to do that in Aspen, but something must have happened. I've since learned that many bookies started as gamblers who got in too deep and had to work off their debts. The first time he left us alone was our first winter there. "You can take care of your sister?" Daddy had asked me. It was an odd question. He said we could sign for what we needed at Carl's Pharmacy. Everything with Daddy is still a puzzle with missing pieces. My best guess is that he drove to Vegas to lay off Super Bowl bets. He was gone 9 days. Ivy and I lived by ourselves in the guest house. "Come, let's away to prison. We two alone will sing like birds in the cage." That was the Lear speech Mom used to recite before bed. It was January. When the school bus dropped us off, we'd hit Carl's, then slip into the little gingerbread house like thieves, the sun already behind Shadow Mountain. We'd turn on all the lights, start a fire, watch TV, and eat our haul of Pharmacy Jolly Ranchers, Pringles, and whatever random piece of fruit sometimes appeared on top of a barrel by the back register. A few days in, Ivy got sick and sicker. 102 fever, wet cough, and an earache that had her moaning. We didn't even have a pediatrician. If I called 911, the police would know we'd been left alone. We'd be taken away, most likely separated. I forged Daddy's signature on notes to school and nursed Ivy with whatever beckoned from the shelves at Carl's. Aspirin, vapor rubs, Sucrets, throat spray, Benadryl, cough syrup. But what might have been still sends shivers. I'd return home every day praying Ivy was alive. She always was, and wanting to hear stories about what had happened at school. 6, she was, being raised by a fourth grader. I didn't dare tell her the truth. I was a fat kid with red hair and freckles, new to town, having moved mid-year from New York. I was tempting prey for the tough kids. As I walked on the path between classes, they'd push me into the pond. I wouldn't fight as they filled my backpack with heaps of fresh powder, snow baths, these wintry interludes were called. But at home, in my afternoon reports to Ivy, I'd have the last word, mocking the bullies' appearances, ridiculing their names, belittling their intellects. "You're awful," Ivy would say through her laughter, my audience of one.
But she knew I wasn't awful. Once, years later, when we were in our 20s and walking up Madison Avenue, Ivy took my hand just to hold. Such was our ease. Despite everything that's happened between us, when I'm taken by surprise, the feeling I have of Ivy is one of